America has long been called the land of opportunity, where the American dream has been and still is the goal. A republic was structured so that designated decision makers can create the avenues, or at least they were supposed to, for that opportunity to flourish and that dream to be realized. More recent times, as you may very well know through your personal experiences, an opportunity and dream, don't they feel like they're becoming more and more distant to you? Many want to know how. I personally believe many more want to know why. My next guest with her new best-selling book answers those questions, not by turning to politicians or pundits for the view, but instead turning to we the people. She does explore what are presented, at least as answers, and whether or not they live up to their promises. Her book is Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. She's opinion editor with Newsweek, Batya Unger Sargon. How are you today, Batya?
Thank God, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me. It's really a pleasure to be here with you.
Well, this is a fantastic book because you humanize so many situations that I think every single person listening to us right now, to one degree or another, will find themselves in that first part of your book of Second Class. My main curiosity is, you set out, this is a book where you had no idea what you were going to find. You had the concept. At what point did you realize, I'm onto something I didn't expect here?
It's such a great question because everybody told me not to write this book. So first I had to like overcome the skepticism of everybody around me, and you know, because I had this feeling that there was a story here to tell. I had this feeling that the class divide in America had really become unignorable, and it was an outrage in a society, in a country that was founded on the idea of the meritocracy and upward mobility and rejecting the sort of strict class divides of Europe. So I knew that this was an important story I wanted to tell, but I didn't know exactly what the story was. You know, my own sort of friends and family networks, there were a lot of people who were working class, but who were also middle class, I would say. They were homeowners or going to be homeowners. They had retirement funds. And I assumed that they were sort of very non-representative of working class America, and that most people were sort of more in the kind of depths of despair category that we hear about a lot.
Right.
People in, you know, like sort of destroyed Rust Belt communities with no hope. And what I found was the picture is really complex. So there's sort of three tiers, I would say, within the working class. There's this sort of high working class, I call them rising working class people in the book, who have achieved the American dream or will achieve the American dream. And then there's the bottom tier of people who really work very hard, and yet they are very poor and constantly beset by anxiety, by, you know, every bill spells potential disaster. And then there's a big, big class in the middle, which is probably the biggest class, where you have people who are covering all their bills, but because of where they live and because of the cost of health care, they do not have any retirement savings and cannot afford property. They'll never own a home. So that sort of when I started realizing, like, oh, yes, it's complex. There's a lot of diversity here in terms of economics, in terms of whether these working class people can achieve the American dream. Then I really knew, like, okay, nobody has told this story yet, that it is complex. And the way working class people explained it to me as I was traveling around interviewing people was, you know, yes, some working class people can still achieve the American dream, but you can do everything right and it's still a crapshoot. It's still sort of 50-50. You know, you cannot control it. You don't have control over whether you will be able to live a stable life or not.
What I learned through that first part, too, between the strugglers, the floaters, and the risers, their expectations are not unrealistic. They're not overly demanding, are they?
No, and this was something that really broke my heart again and again. The things these people want are so modest. You know, there's a woman who I profiled in the book named Nicole, and for 6 months that I was talking to her, she had no teeth. This is a woman who's my age. She's 43 years old because she had lost her teeth due to a COVID-related infection, and the only dentist in her area who took her insurance was backed up for 6 months. So she had no teeth. She drives for DoorDash, and she was driving a car that had no windows because her car broke down and she had to use her father's car because she couldn't afford to fix her car. But her father's car had no windows and she couldn't afford to replace them, so she was driving around in a car with boarded up windows. I asked Nicole, how much would you need to make a year to not feel poor, to not constantly feel like you can't give your kid what he needs, to feel like you're constantly worried about your bills. She said to me, $38,000 a year. If she could get to $38,000 a year, she would feel safe. Like, it's so modest what people want, a home, a retirement, and they work so hard. And yet these features that the elites take for granted, I mean, they never think twice about them. They're out of reach for so many working class Americans.
And let's spend a little time on the elites, because they're obviously the placate and the problem. We have one side, which I would say primarily is on the right, who would say, well, move somewhere else where the cost of living is cheaper, or get a second job, which, having done that myself in my early days in radio, is not as easy as it sounds. And I've known two people who fell asleep behind the wheel and lost their lives because they're going from one job to another, and they were just wearing themselves down. Then you have primarily on the left, where the answer is more programs, more handouts, which has a trickle-down effect for those who are the working class, that it costs more because more of their money is going into programs which produce really no results.
You nailed it. You know, neither side, when you look at the major paradigms for the economy on the left and on the right, is offering an economy that delivers for working class Americans. Working class people don't want welfare. Like, that's all the left has to answer them with. They say, oh, you can't afford a home, we'll build you affordable housing, we'll give you a voucher so you can do Section 8 housing. They don't want that. They work really hard, and they feel deeply insulted at the idea that they should get a handout from the government. What they want is the dignity of being able to support themselves and their families based on the fruit of their labor, which is intense and which they're very proud of. They love working. They get a lot of dignity from work. But on the right, this trickle-down idea of, you know, free trade and being, you know, the Chamber of Commerce version of the Republican Party before Trump, I mean, that clearly didn't work either. There was actually a handshake agreement between both parties for decades that, you know, the answer to all of our problems was more free trade, more trade deals. And that resulted, of course, in NAFTA, signed into law by Bill Clinton, which resulted in shipping 5 million very, very good working class jobs overseas to build up China and Mexico's middle class. So there really, you know, doesn't exist this paradigm. And when you talk to the left, they say, well, we'll just give them more. Working class people don't want that. When you talk to the right, they say, well, they should move. Guess what? They can't afford to move. A lot of these people have kids, and you know who picks up the kid and brings them home from school while they're at work? A parent. I mean, they're very connected to their communities because of the precariousness of their lives. It's very difficult to pick up and move like that.
Torah Batya Unger Sargon, author of the book Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. She's also opinion editor with Newsweek, on X at B Unger Sargon and Newsweek.com, the respective websites. You're listening to Issues and Ideas. Here's the crazy part that I had always thought about, and your book confirmed it for me at least. Manufacturing jobs have been farmed out to every direction they get farmed out to, out of the country. And we're told now, you need a college degree. That's a necessity if you want to make it in this country. Manufacturing jobs are numerous because consumers are a constant. College degree jobs are limited because, well, those two are getting farmed out to other countries. And there's a smaller number of college degree tech jobs, for example, just internet, whatever you know, wherever you want to contemplate executives. Well, okay, I got to start somewhere. I'm not going to start as an executive. It just seems like the steps of solution were willingly given away, and the working class and the middle class are the ones who are suffering for it.
You're 100% correct. The last 50 years of Democratic policy has been a plunder of the middle class by the college-credentialed elites in the knowledge industry. They effectively passed, you know, policy after policy after policy. They started with NAFTA, which shipped these jobs overseas. Then President Obama defunded vocational training in high schools. What a mistake. I mean, we're always going to need plumbers and electricians. There's a huge dearth of skilled tradesfolk in America. And yet the idea for the Democrats is, well, we'll send everybody to college. And you're absolutely right. 50% of people with a college education are underemployed, meaning that they are not using any skills they acquired in college for their jobs. Our economy is oversaturated with degree holders and in a complete dearth of people who can do things that we actually rely on to survive. And it was absolutely a plunder and absolutely intentional. I don't think they meant to make working class people poor. I think maybe they meant to make working class people into Democrats again by sending them to college, because that's a pretty sure thing, right?
Yeah.
But, you know, there's a real fundamental cultural difference between where the working class is at and the Democratic Party right now as well. Working class people are very connected and committed to the idea of their own autonomy. They want self-determination. They work extremely hard, and they just want dignity. The Democratic Party platform, which has been created by these over-credentialed college elites, is very committed to a more paternalistic view of the world in which big government and institutions have a lot of power and a lot of control. And the reason for that is because if you are a college-educated elite, you love institutions because they've worked really well for you. I mean, look at how the Democrats used government, used economics to plunder the middle class and send all of that GDP up into the top 20%.
Just to give you, for you listening, the imbalance, federal funding to colleges, $150 billion. Federal funding to vo-tech schools, $1 billion. Therein lies a small slice of the problem. Part two of your book, you pose the question, how can the lives of working class Americans be improved with good jobs, whose jobs, benefits cliff, and housing? When we say benefits, again, we're not looking for handouts. We just want to have a fair, equitable way to build a not just a present security, but a future security.
Something that working class people brought up to me a lot was they really don't like welfare. They all new people who they felt were scamming the system, who had chosen not to work and live off the government while they worked really, really hard. At the same time, they felt that people who they saw as deserving could not get the help they needed when they needed it. And there's a perverse incentive structure, and it's called the benefits cliff. And what that refers to is, say you have a single mom and, you know, she's working part time and she's making $10 an hour, let's say. And maybe her kid has a disability or has some, you know, learning trouble or something. And they have Medicaid, which is, of course, the Cadillac of health insurances. And let's say she's a really good worker. She shows up on time. She's super invested. And her boss notices her and says, hey, you're a hard worker. You show up. You're reliable. I like being around you. You're great to work with. I want to give you a raise. I want to get you to $15 an hour and give you full-time employment. What do you say to that? If she takes that raise from $11 an hour to $15 an hour full-time work, she will be giving up the equivalent of $25,000 in benefits, whether it's free child care, free health care, food stamps, Section 8 housing. And, of course, the difference between $11 to $15 an hour is not $25,000 an hour.
No.
That is the cliff she will drop off. And the worst part about it is, even if she gets health care through her job, she won't know ahead of time how good the health care is, what the premiums are, whether it will cover all the services her child needs. So the whole system is set up to disincentivize autonomy, to disincentivize self-determination and hard work paying off.
One of the many lessons from your book Second Class was what we are told by the politicians and the polls are supposedly priorities among the middle class really aren't. I mean, they're interested in politics. Maybe those are the ones that we see more and more get interested the closer we get to an election, whether it's a primary or general election. They're interested in how immigration is being addressed, not a top priority, but. Does the answer begin and end within, not with one party, but somewhere in the middle? You mentioned handshake agreements in the past, which never came to fruition. Do we have to find a compromise where a little bit here, a little bit there is what's going to provide the return to a more solid path, a clear path to this being a land of opportunity and the American dream once again being within reach?
You know, the most common view that I heard was somewhere in the middle on all issues. So the American working class is radically moderate, deeply tolerant, conservative, but wants a protectionist economy. And this was whether they were liberals or conservatives. So very little distinguished the lesbian certified nurse's aide who votes for Biden and lives in Florida from the Trump-loving Amazon driver who lives in West Virginia. Like, their views of the world were extremely similar. They were both extremely pro-gay, but very worried about the transgender agenda. They were both, you know, really against welfare, but also felt that it was fair to ask corporations and the rich to pay more. They were both against immigration, both legal and illegal for the foreseeable future, but thought that there should be some sort of government-backed healthcare program so that people don't go into medical bankruptcy. They both spent all of their savings every year on healthcare premiums and on their deductible. And so what I keep saying is, you know, the first party that gets to this combination of let's have a moratorium on immigration for 10 years and a government-backed healthcare is going to get 70% of the vote. Now, is it more likely that the Democrats will get there or the Republicans will get there? It's probably unlikely that either will get there because they're both so committed to their respective donor classes. On one side, open borders and talking about healthcare. On the other hand, never talking about healthcare, but talking about the border, right? But the American working class is somewhere in the middle on those issues. And it's funny to me that neither their parties are not racing to this position because the polling is very clear. This is where 70-75% of Americans are at.
And you don't even have to look at polling. If you look at a state like New Jersey, for example, the largest block of voters are declared independents, not Republican, not Democrat, and there are many other states similar, if that's not a telltale sign. But then again, they say power is a drug, but there is a way to send the people with power into rehab and get them back into focusing on the people. I believe Batya's book, Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women, is part of that rehab to make things right. Certainly get a copy for yourself because you'll see yourself in the stories of these people. I guarantee you that. As well as you'll find what the beliefs are versus what we're told they are two very different things among we the people. I suggest you get a second copy, too, and send that to either a member of your state legislature or Congress, because those are the people who need. How can you help and empower someone that you're not listening to and therefore not understanding? Well, what Batya does with Second Class is, she does that communicating of these stories of so many people from so many backgrounds, all wanting to make a difference, all wanting to build their lives, and they just want opportunity. Is that a lot to ask? I don't think so. I don't think you don't think that's outrageous either. Second Class, How the Elites Betrayed America's Working Men and Women. She's also opinion editor with Newsweek. Batya Unger Sargon, thank you for telling these incredible stories and the understanding, the awakening that your book is going to give so many people. I hope the right ones as well get that awakening and start making a difference. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. God bless you.